On Sunday, a brand new movie prequel to The Lord of the Rings is premiering. It's a 40-minute high-definition film released over the internet. The prequel was made by fans who earn no profit on it. Still, NPR's Laura Seidel reports that the producers are walking a fuzzy legal line.
The Hunt for Gollum looks just like the Hollywood version. I was fooled the first time I saw it.
Precious.
The actors are dead ringers for the stars of The Lord of the Rings. The costumes appear identical. The special effects in the trailer are flawless. But The Hunt for Gollum is the work of 150 volunteers.
We're essentially a bunch of fans and enthusiast filmmakers making this unofficially.
Chris Bouchard is the director. He's been working on this 40-minute mini-feature for 2 years. He made up the plot, which focuses on a search to find the deranged Gollum. The fear is that Gollum might reveal the whereabouts of the magic ring to the powers of darkness.
I guess this story is really just a small chapter when you compare to a full feature film. But we tried to expand it a bit and try and show the epic scale of Middle-earth as well in kind of a tribute to what Peter Jackson did.
Of course, Academy Award-winning screenwriter and director Peter Jackson might not consider this production a tribute. Nor might New Line Cinema, which produced the Lord of the Rings trilogy into film, or J.R.R. Tolkien's family, which owns the rights to his books.
Well, I think it's an interesting question.
Fred von Lohmann is an attorney with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Von Lohmann says it's not really clear whether or not Bouchard and his crew of volunteers are in violation of the copyright for Tolkien's work. Von Lohmann says fans have always written their own stories based on TV shows and movies. That's legal. But a high-quality movie available over the internet could change the game.
Now the fans can reach a global audience immediately through the internet. And now we have video hosting sites that can, you know, make that available in a global way.
Von Lohmann says he could imagine a court might decide that The Hunt for Gollum violates the copyright of the Tolkien family because it may get in the way of their right to make money on licensing and franchising. The entire 40-minute film will be released on Sunday in HD on the internet. You can see the trailer right now on our website, npr.org. Laura Seidel, NPR News.
Al Jazeera covers a lot more than just news in the Muslim world. It operates sports channels, a documentary channel, even a children's channel. Egyptian TV watchers are also tuning in to what was once considered a uniquely American phenomenon, the flashy televangelist. NPR's Susanna George makes the connection in Cairo, Egypt.
This is the theme song from A Tariq As-Sah, The Right Path. Host Moez Masoud is an unlikely televangelist. He left university with an economics degree. He wears a neat Western-style suit and doesn't sport a beard. The show airs on the Iqra channel. Its fancy graphics, sleek set, and crisp lighting look like something straight out of MTV. Moez preaches moderate Islam. His show addresses subjects that range from first date etiquette to how to wear your headscarf. One of his toughest challenges? Battling misconceptions that Muslims have about their own faith, even on the simplest level.
The idea of happiness. We think that while on the right path, that we're not allowed to be happy. Religion has been presented in such a way to us that it makes us feel that happiness and being a pious Muslim are mutually exclusive.
Moez is hardly the only person preaching Islam on TV. Egyptian Amr Khaled studied accounting before he began giving religious lectures in Cairo nearly 10 years ago. Today, he preaches on the Egyptian television channel El Mahwar. He's sometimes known as the Dr. Phil of the Arab world.
My message is very clear to make development in this area of the world, the Middle East, through youth and women. Because I believe that youth and women in this area can do a big role to change, unfortunately, the very bad image about our countries.
But unlike Moez, Amr is not concerned with reconciling a Muslim faith with a Western lifestyle.
I open channels to ask people, put your faith in this area to make a better future for your country. If you are going to listen to the few numbers of people who want to destroy, you will get nothing. I'm talking on behalf of youth. They want to build, not destroy.
Amr says that if you really want to reach youth in the Arab world, Islam has got to be an essential part of your message.
The faith in this area of the world is the language. To say we don't want to talk about faith in the Middle East, you are not to understand what are the roots of this area of the world.
Televangelists like Amr Khaled and Moez Masoud are not without their detractors. Critics of Moez claim that he is promoting Islam light, a watered-down version of Islam that ignores the inherent clashes between the religion and a Western life. Moez's response?
I'm flattered because Islam is all about light, L-I-G-H-T. But of course, if they want to spell it L-I-T-E, if by that you mean that I've gotten rid of all the excessive baggage that you've put onto it because of your narrow-mindedness, then yes, it's a lot lighter than your overweight Islam. But if they mean that I've actually taken something away from the essentials of the faith, then I would say that's a very bold accusation, and I would like to see proof.
Their messages are slightly different, but both Moez Masoud and Amr Khaled particularly appeal to young Muslims. Moez says they can identify with him.
Maybe they consider me someone who's been there and done that, you know, traveled the world and also lived the quote-unquote party lifestyle and stuff. It's like Bob Dylan. He said, and don't criticize what you cannot understand. And I think that we feel this way towards those people who speak to us about the faith, but from an ivory tower and who've never been there and done that.
Whether or not moderate preachers like Moez Masoud and Amr Khaled are antidotes to extremism or just passing fads isn't clear, but both have a large and growing following. Susanna George, NPR News, Cairo.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. Fans of TV shows Without a Trace, Lie to Me, and Numbers take note of this next item. Your show might not be back this fall. Or as they say in the business, it's one of many shows on the bubble. The Hollywood Reporter's Andrew Wallenstein gives us this lesson in Hollywood jargon.
Think of the bubble as a kind of purgatory occupied by series that are neither monster hits nor outright duds. This time of year, TV execs sit in judgment of their shows, which exist in a state of limbo, uncertain whether they will live to see another season. Now, shows on the bubble aren't just ranked by their ratings and cut accordingly. There's actually a whole host of other factors that could end up sealing their fate. Here's one reason. A network may have developed something better to replace it with.
Oh, I was just wondering how many men it takes to change a light bulb.
Take a show like the long-running ABC comedy, According to Jim. Somehow, Jim managed to survive for 8 years, despite the fact it hasn't gotten decent ratings in ages. That's because ABC has had little luck in recent years developing new sitcoms, particularly fluffy family fare like Jim.
Guys, I can't find the light bulb.
You better believe if the network develops something in that mold with real potential, Jim is as good as gone. Which brings me to my second reason. Jim is produced by ABC Studios, which may have extended its life on the bubble. A network is likelier to stick with a project when its parent company doesn't pay someone else to produce the show. A third factor for bubble shows? The older a show is, the more expensive it gets. Take the popular CBS procedural Without a Trace.
Keith, I'm Special Agent Johnson with the FBI.
Okay, take it easy. We're gonna airlift you out of here.
Now, for a show in its seventh season, Trace actually has pretty respectable audience levels. But the cost of a show typically rises over the duration of its run. You gotta give stars raises if you want to keep them around, for one thing. NBC was doing its own penny-pinching with its controversial decision to put Jay Leno in prime time 5 nights a week. He may not get the kind of ratings a scripted show gets, but his show is going to be much cheaper to produce. Which brings me to a fourth factor creating trouble for the bubble shows, at least on NBC. The addition of Leno means there's almost a third less room for existing shows. That could mean curtains for a middling performer like that quirky spy romp, Chuck.
Put him on the helicopter. Kill the CIA agent.
He's my son.
He's your son?
Congratulations, that's great!
I had no idea. Kill his son.
Chuck would have probably stood a better chance if Jay Leno weren't taking up so much real estate. But like it or not, TV is a zero-sum game. New shows come in only when the old ones are moved out.
Andrew Wallenstein is an editor at The Hollywood Reporter.
Question in the form of an answer. This music is from a hugely popular television game show. Answer in the form of a question. What is Jeopardy? We play the music in honor of the news that IBM is designing an advanced question answering system. I've interviewed people who fit that description. To compete with humans on Jeopardy. David Ferrucci is the project director and an IBM artificial intelligence researcher in Yorktown Heights, New York. He joins us from his office. Hi.
Hi.
How close are you to a computerized Jeopardy competitor?
Well, I think we're pretty close. We've been working on it for a couple of years at this point. There's a lot more to do, but we think that we'll be competitive against grand champions.
How does playing Jeopardy compare in difficulty with, say, playing chess, which would seem to be a much more predictable universe that you're trying to work within?
Well, you're exactly right. I mean, chess is a lot more predictable. There's a finite number of moves, albeit, you know, very many. With something like Jeopardy, there's just a huge, huge domain of possibilities. And, you know, it presents a very different sort of challenge for the computer.
What kind of a database will your system, which I gather is named Watson for Thomas Watson of IBM, what kind of a database will it draw on for its answers?
Well, it's a large database comprised mostly of natural language corpora, so different sorts of books, reference material, many, many texts, news information, such a wide variety of documents. And the computer program is challenged to understand both the question that's being asked as well as the content that it's read and stored in its memories.
I was thinking, you know, I used "What is Jeopardy?" in the introduction, and I imagined a category in which that would be one of the clues. I made up the category, par for the course. And the other clues would be unreasonable fear, board game based on one from India, topping for spaghetti, and Athenian landmark.
Wow, great clue. I don't know the answer. Maybe Watson might be able to get it.
Well, you see, but there's a PAR in each of those answers.
That's right.
Par, so would Watson be able just to find words with PAR, figure out that's where the joke is, or does he need Alex Trebek to say, as you can imagine, all of these answers will have PAR in them?
In that particular case, it would not make that difference. But as it starts to see other answers revealed, it will look for patterns there as well. So it may discover, starting out with not being confident enough to answer one of those questions, it may look at the answers coming out and then, for example, say, okay, I'm starting to see a pattern in these other answers, and then figure it out.
So it could take on board. It hears paranoia from one and Parmesan cheese from the other, and it can figure out Parcheesi based on that.
Yeah, it can. Correct. There's some expectation that there would be repeated patterns in the categories or the answer so that it would be able to figure it out. So it will not rely on understanding new procedures and clues that Alex would explain. It would only rely on having trained over the existing data and over the language in its databases.
I mean, the challenge here, given the idea that, you know, these are kind of trivia questions, but they're drawn from every kind of information we gather throughout life, is really to equip an, as you say, an answering system with a phenomenal amount of information.
Well, that's right. I mean, I think one of the classic challenges in this whole field of automatic question answering is this notion of open domain or broad knowledge where, you know, you're not told ahead of time, you know, it's just going to be about this topic. So that's clearly one of the important aspects of the particular Jeopardy challenge. I mean, that, the high levels of precision that are required, the speed, and of course the confidence. And dealing with that breadth of domain is an interesting aspect of this and has, I think, driven our, has helped generalize essentially our solution to this problem.
Ken Jennings, biggest
Correct.
Winner ever in Jeopardy.
Yes.
When are you going to be ready to take him head to head?
Well, we're not ready right now. There's work to do, but we think we'll get there.
We think in months or are we thinking years here, David?
Oh, I hope that we'll be ready to do something like that within a year, maybe a little bit longer, but hopefully within a year.
Well, we look forward to it.
Appreciate that.
Thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
It's David Ferrucci of IBM, who's the project director in developing Watson, an advanced question answering system that he says is perhaps a year away from competing with human contestants on Jeopardy.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News.